Her pain the moment they smelled it. Thin the herd, thin the herd, thin the herd. One day she wouldn't be able to board the elevator again. The next, she'd need to have her groceries delivered. She'd wake up a few years from now and realize she couldn't remember the last time she'd left the building. She'd have no more power over herself or her terrors. And where had that power come from? It had come from herself, yes, of course it had. But it had also come from him. It had come from love. Or what she mistook for love. An actor. Her Brian was an actor. He'd practically rubbed her face in it during the argument after his return from London when he'd made reference to Clark Rockefeller, which meant not only was Brian not Brian, he wasn't a Delacroix. But how was that possible? She went back online, searched for Brian Delacroix. The bio that came up matched what Brian had told her. 40, employee of Delacroix Lumber, a Canadian lumber concern with holdings in 26 countries. She clicked images and found only 4, but there he was, her Brian. Same hair, same jawline, same eyes, same... not the same nose. Her Brian had that bump just above the septum at the beginning of the nasal bone. Unnoticeable head-on, but discernible in profile. Even then, it could escape notice if you weren't looking for it. But if you were, it wasn't up for argument. He had a bump on the bridge of his nose. Brian Delacroix did not. 2 of the photos were profiles. No bump. She took a longer look at the head-on shots, and the longer she looked into Brian Delacroix's eyes, the more she realized she'd never looked into them before. Her Brian Delacroix, Brett Alden, was an actor. Andrew Gaddis, his inconvenient friend from the past, was an actor. Caleb knew both of them quite comfortably. It seemed a rational leap that Caleb might be an actor, too. As the dark settled over the river, she texted him. "Got a moment to swing by?" A minute later, he responded. "No problem. What do you need?" "Tiny bit of muscle, rearranging a few things before B gets back." "See you in 15." "Thanks." Her cell vibrated. Glenn. "Hey."
"Hey,"
he said.
"What's this company to you, Rachel?"
"Nothing much. Why?"
"It's a rinky-dink operation that owns a rinky-dink mine in Papua New Guinea. However..."
She heard him click his mouse a couple times.
"Turns out the mine might not be so rinky-dink. Rumor has it a consulting firm did an assessment and found out Alden Minerals could be sitting on resources of up to 400 million troy ounces."
"I came across something about that," she said. "What are troy ounces, by the way?"
"Gold measurement." "Sorry, it's literally a gold mine. Won't do them much good, though. The major competition in that region, the only competition they'd have, is Vitterman Copper and Gold, and they don't play nice in the sandbox. And Vitterman would never fucking ever allow a mine to be sitting in that region on that kind of load and not have their name on it. So at some point there's going to be a hostile takeover. Which is why Alden has been trying to keep news of the consulting company's findings hush-hush. Unfortunately for them, they needed more cash. They took several meetings with Cotter McCann."
"Who's that?"
"A venture capital group.
Last week, Cotter McCann leased several parcels of land suitable for commercial real estate near Arawa Township in Papua New Guinea.
What's that tell you?"
Rachel had drunk too much wine for it to tell her anything.
"I don't know." "Well, it tells me Cotter McCann gave Alden Minerals an infusion of cash, probably for a shitload of shares in that mine. When it starts to pay off, they'll push Alden Minerals aside and clean up. It's what they do. They're sharks. Worse than sharks, some say. Even sharks stop eating when they're full."
"So Alden Minerals will probably fail."
"Fail is not quite the right word. They'll be subsumed. Either by Vitterman or Cotter McCann. They went from A-ball to the major leagues overnight. I doubt they can handle the pitching."
"Ah." She couldn't put any of it together. "Thanks so much, Glenn."
"Of course. Hey, Melissa told me you're making your way back out into the world."
"She did?"
Rachel swallowed a scream. "You've got to come out to the house. Meet Amelia. We'd love to see you guys."
A wave of despair hit her. "We'd love that."
You okay?
Oh, yeah. Just got a cold.
For a moment, it felt like he might press the issue, but then he said, Take care, Rachel. When Caleb rang the bell, she buzzed him up. She'd laid her evidence on the kitchen counter by a scotch glass and a bottle of bourbon, but he didn't notice it when he first came in. He looked distracted and worn out.
You got a drink?
She pointed at the bourbon. He took a seat at the counter. He poured himself a drink, didn't even notice the other items on the counter.
Hell of a day.
Oh, you had one too, she said. He took a long pull on the glass.
Sometimes I think Brian was right.
About what?
Getting married, having a kid. It's a lot of moving parts, a lot of balls in the air.
He glanced at the items on the counter, and his tone grew distracted.
So what needs lifting?
Nothing, really.
So why?
He narrowed his eyes at one of Brian's plane tickets, the receipt from the shop in Covent Garden, a photo she'd printed up of the selfie Brian had taken outside the Covent Garden Hotel, the VHS of Since I Fell for You. Caleb took a pull from his drink and looked across at her.
You wrote the date wrong.
She pointed at the receipt. He gave her a confused smile.
You wrote it as month, day, year. In Britain, it would read day, month, year.
He glanced at the receipt, then back over at her.
I have no idea what you're...
I followed him.
Caleb took another drink. To Providence. Caleb was very still. The building was just as still around them. Trust Fund Baby was definitely not home. She would have heard his footsteps. The other tenants on 15 weren't there either. It was as if they sat atop an eyrie in a forest at the far reaches of the earth.
He has a pregnant wife.
She poured herself more wine. He's an actor, but then you knew that because... She pointed her wine glass at him.
You're an actor.
I don't know what you're...
Bullshit. Bullshit.
She downed half her wine. At this rate, she'd be peeling the foil off a second bottle soon. But she didn't care, because it felt good to have focus for her rage. It gave her the illusion of power. And at this point, she'd take illusions if they beat back the terror.
What do you think you know?
He said. Don't you fucking speak to me in that tone.
What tone?
The condescending one. He held up his hands like a man being robbed at gunpoint. She said, I saw Brian go to Providence. I saw Brian at Alden Minerals. I saw Brian go to a camera store and buy flowers and go to a bank. And I saw Brian and his preg-
What do you mean he went to the camera store?
He went to a camera store.
The one on Broadway?
She didn't know how she'd managed to strike a nerve, only that she had. Caleb scowled at his reflection in the marble countertop, scowled at his glass, before draining it of bourbon.
What's in the camera store?
After a minute of silence, she said, Caleb? He held up a finger to silence her, and called someone on his cell. As he waited, she could hear the rings on the other end. She was still back to the finger he'd raised to silence her, the contempt in it. It reminded her of Dr. Felix Browner. He'd dismissed her in the same way once. He pressed end on his cell and immediately tried another number. No answer there, either. He pressed end again and then squeezed the phone so hard she expected it to shatter. He said to her,
Tell me some...
She turned her back on him. She retrieved the bottle of wine from the counter beside the oven, kept her back to him as she refilled her glass. It was petty of her, but that didn't make it feel any less sweet. When she turned back to him, the glare on his face vanished a half second after she noted it, and he smiled a very Caleb-esque smile, boyish and sleepy.
Tell me some more about what you saw in Providence.
You first. She placed her wine down on the counter across from him.
There's nothing for me to tell.
He shrugged.
I don't know anything.
She nodded. Then leave. His sleepy smile turned into a sleepy chuckle.
Why would I do that?
If you don't know anything, Caleb, then I don't know anything.
Ah.
He unscrewed the cap on the bourbon and poured himself another two fingers. He put the cap back on, swirled the liquor in his glass.
You're 100% sure you saw Brian enter the camera store?
She nodded.
How long was he in there?
Who's Andrew Gaddis? He gave that a touche nod as he took a drink.
He's an actor.
I know that. Tell me something I don't know.
He went to Trinity Rep in Providence.
The acting school. Another nod.
It's where we all met.
So my husband's an actor?
Pretty much, yeah. So, the camera store. How long was he in there?
She looked across the counter at him for a bit. About 5 minutes, tops. He gnawed the inside of his mouth.
He come back out with anything?
What's Brian's real name? She couldn't fucking believe the words left her mouth. Who in her life ever expected to ask that about her husband?
Alden,
he said. Brett? He shook his head.
Brian. Brett was his stage name. My turn.
She shook her head. No, no, no. You've been withholding information from me since we met. I just started tonight. You get one question for every two of mine.
What if that isn't good enough?
She wiggled her fingers at the door behind him. Then fuck off, my friend.
You're drunk.
I'm buzzed, she said. What's at the offices in Cambridge?
Nothing. It's never used. A friend owns it. If we need it, like, say, you're coming over and we have warning, we dress it, just like a stage.
So who are the interns?
You've already had your two questions.
But in that moment, she saw the answer, as if it had descended from the heavens decked out in neon. They're actors, she said.
Ding.
Caleb checked an imaginary box in the air before his eyes.
Gold Star. Did Brian leave the camera store with anything?
Not that I saw. He checked her eyes.
Did he go to the bank before or after the camera store?
That's a second question.
Be kind.
She laughed so hard she almost threw up. Laughed the way flood victims and earthquake survivors laughed. Laughed not because something was funny, but because nothing was. Kind? She said. Kind? Caleb made a steeple of his hands and placed his forehead to their point, a supplicant, a martyr waiting to be sculpted. After no sculptor arrived, he raised his head. His face was ash, his eye sockets dark. He was aging as she watched. She swirled her wine but didn't drink it. How'd he fake the selfie from London?
I did it.
He rotated his glass of bourbon on the countertop a full 360.
He texted me, told me what was up. You were sitting right across from me in Grendel's. It was all just hitting buttons on a phone, snatching an image here, an image there, and running it through a photo program. If you'd looked at it in high res on a decent computer screen, it probably wouldn't have held up. But for a selfie supposedly taken in low light, it was easy.
Caleb, she said, the wine definitely hitting her now. What am I part of?
Huh?
I woke up this morning, I was someone's wife. Now I'm what, I'm one of his wives? In one of his lives? What am I?
You're you,
he said. What's that mean?
You're you,
he said.
You're unaltered, pure. You haven't changed. Your husband's not who you thought he was, yes, but that doesn't change who you are.
He reached across the counter and took her fingers in his hands.
You're you.
She pulled her fingers free of his. He left his hands on the counter. She looked at her own hands, at the two rings there, a round, solitaire diamond engagement ring sitting atop a platinum wedding band with five more round diamonds. She once took them to be cleaned at a jeweler's on Water Street. One, she now realized, Brian had recommended, and the old man who owned the place whistled at them.
A man who would give you such precious stones?
The old man said, adjusting his glass. Whoof!
He must love you very much.
Her hands began to shake as she looked at them, at the flesh, at the jewels, and wondered if anything, anything in her life was real. These last 3 years had been first a crawl and then a climb toward sanity, toward reclamation of her life and herself. A series of baby steps taken in a tsunami of doubt and terror. A blind woman walking down a series of corridors in an unfamiliar building she could not remember entering. And who had arrived to guide her? Who had taken her hand and whispered, trust me, until she finally did? Who had walked her toward the sun? Brian. Brian had believed in her long after anyone else had gone home. Brian had pulled her out of the hopeless dark. All of it was a lie? She was surprised to hear the words leave her mouth, and surprised to see the tears fall on the marble countertop and on her hands and on her rings. They rolled down the sides of her nose and off her cheekbones and into the corners of her mouth. They burned a bit. She moved to get a Kleenex, but Caleb took her hands again.
"It's okay,"
he said.
"Let it out."
She wanted to tell him it wasn't okay, any of it, and would he please let go of her hands? She pulled her hands out of his.
"Leave." "What?"
"Just go. I want to be alone."
"You can't be alone."
"No, I'll be fine."
"No," he said. "You know too much."
She couldn't repeat the rest of his threat. It was a threat, wasn't it?
"He won't like it if I leave you alone."
Now she repeated it. "Because I know too much."
"You know what I mean."
"No, I don't." She left the gun in the chair over by the picture window.
"Brian and I have been at this for a very long time,"
he said.
"There's a lot of money at stake."
"How much?"
"A lot."
"And you think I might tell someone?" He smiled and drank some bourbon.
"I don't think you necessarily will, but I think you could."
"Uh-huh." She carried her wine glass with her to the window, but Caleb came right along with her. They stood by the chair and looked out at the lights of Cambridge, and if Caleb looked down, he'd see the gun. "Is that why you married a woman who didn't speak the language?" He said nothing, and she tried not to look down at the chair. "Who doesn't know anyone in this country?" He looked out at the night, but moved his hips slightly closer to the chair and kept his eyes on her reflection in the window. "Is that why Brian married a shut-in?" Eventually, Caleb said,
"This could be so good for everyone."
He met her eyes in the dark glass.
"So don't make it bad."
"Are you threatening me?" she said softly.
"I think it's you who's been doing the threatening tonight, kid."
And he looked at her the way the rapist, Teacher Paul, had in Haiti. Or at least that's how it felt in the moment. "Do you know where Brian is?" she asked.
"I know where he might be."
"Can you take me to him?"
"Why would I do that?"
"Because he owes me an explanation."
"Or?"
"Or what?"
"That's what I'm asking. Are you giving us an or else?"
"Caleb," she said, and hated how desperate she sounded. "Take me to Brian."
"No."
"No?"
"Brian has something I need, something my family needs. I don't like that he has that and hasn't told me."
She felt herself trying to swim up through the wine again. "Brian has something you... the camera store?" Caleb nodded.
"The camera store."
"What?"
"He has something I need, and you're something he needs."
He turned to face her, the chair between them.
"So I'm not going to take you to him just yet."
She reached down, grabbed the pistol, thumbed off the safety, and pointed at the center of his chest. "Yes," she said. "You are." Chapter 22. The Snowblower. Driving them south in his silver Audi, Caleb said,
"You can put the gun away."
"No," she said. "I like having it." She didn't. She didn't like having it at all. It sat in her hand like dead vermin that might spring back to life. Its power to stop a life with the flexing of a finger was suddenly one of the ugliest concepts she'd ever considered, and she'd pointed it at a friend, was even now pointing it generally at him.
"Could you put the safety on?"
"That would add an extra step in case I have to pull the trigger."
"But you're not going to pull the trigger. It's me, and you're you. Do you get how ridiculous this is?"
"I do," she said. "It's ridiculous for sure."
So now that we've agreed you're not going to shoot me...
We haven't agreed on that.
But I'm driving,
he pointed out, his tone falling somewhere between helpful and condescending.
So you're going to shoot me and, what, sit in the passenger seat as the car goes flying across the expressway?
That's what airbags are for.
I don't believe you.
If you try to take the gun from me, she said, the only choice I'll have is to, you know, shoot you. He jerked the wheel and the car lurched into the next lane. He smiled at her.
Well, that felt unpleasant.
She could feel the power dynamic shifting, and she knew from the housing projects and the ride-alongs and the long nights in Haiti that when power shifted, it stayed shifted unless you grabbed it back immediately. His eyes were on the road when she flicked the safety on. It didn't make a sound. She shifted in her seat, leaned forward slightly, and slammed the butt of the pistol down on his kneecap. The car lurched and swerved again. A horn blared. Caleb hissed.
Holy fuck! What is wrong with you? That fucking...
She did it again, exactly the same spot. He jerked the car back out of a third swerve.
Enough!
They'd be lucky if another car on the freeway wasn't calling 911 right now to report a drunk driver, giving the operator Caleb's license plate number. She flicked the safety off again.
Enough,
he repeated. Riding his vocal cords along with the anger and attempted authority was a clear timbre of anxiety. He had no idea what she was going to do next, but he was definitely afraid of the possibilities. So now the power had shifted back. He exited the freeway in Dorchester, in the southern tip of Neponset. He headed north on Gallivan Boulevard, stayed right at the rotary, and at first she thought they were crossing the bridge to Quincy, but instead he headed for the on-ramp back onto the expressway. At the last moment, he turned right and drove down a street badly in need of repaving. They bounced along until he turned right and took them into a blocks-long stretch of bent, weather-lashed houses and Quonset-shaped warehouses and dry dockyards filled with boats that ran to the smaller side. At the end of the street, they found the Port Charlotte Marina, something Sebastian had pointed out to her a few times on their sails through Massachusetts Bay their first few summers together. Sebastian showing her how to steer and navigate at night by the lights in the sky. Sebastian out on the water with the wind in his Nordic hair, the only time she'd ever known him to be happy. A restaurant and yacht club sat just past a near-deserted parking lot. Both buildings looking freshly painted and hopeful for a marina in which there were no yachts. The biggest boat moored at the dock looked to be a 40-footer. Most of the others looked to be lobster boats, aged and constructed of wood. A few of the newer ones were fiberglass. The nicest of those was about 35 feet long, the hull painted blue, the wheelhouse painted white, the deck a honey teak. She paid attention to it because her husband stood on it, bathed in their headlights. Caleb exited the car fast. He pointed back at her, told Brian his wife was not taking things well. Rachel was happy to note Caleb limped, even as he speed-walked to the boat. She, on the other hand, moved slowly, her eyes on Brian. His gaze barely left hers except for the occasional flicks in the direction of Caleb. If she'd known she'd end up killing him, would she have boarded the boat? She could turn around and go to the police. My husband is an imposter, she'd say. She imagined some smarmy desk sergeant replying, "Aren't we all, ma'am?" Yes, she was certain it was a crime to impersonate someone, and a crime to keep two wives, but were those serious crimes? In the end, wouldn't Brian just take a plea and it would all go away? She'd be left the laughingstock never was. The failed print reporter who'd become a pill-addicted broadcast reporter who'd become a punchline and then a shut-in and who would keep the local comic stocked with weeks of fresh material once it was discovered that meltdown media chick had married a con man with another wife and another life. She followed Caleb up the ramp to the boat. He stepped aboard. When she went to do the same, Brian offered his hand. She stared at it until he dropped it. He noticed the gun she carried.
Should I show you mine, so I feel safer?
Be my guest. She stepped aboard. As she did, Brian caught her by the wrist and stripped the gun from her hand in the same motion. He pulled his own gun, a .38 snub-nosed revolver, from under the flaps of his shirt, and then laid them both on a table by the stern.
"Once we get out into the bay, sweetheart, you let me know if you want to walk 5 paces and draw. I owe you that."
"You owe me a lot more than that." He nodded.
"And I'm going to make good on it."
He unraveled a line from the cleat, and before she'd even realized she could hear the engine, Caleb was under the standing shelter with his hand on the throttle, and they were chugging up the Neponset River toward the bay. Brian sat on the bench on one side of the deck, and she sat across from him, the front edge of the table in between them.
"So you own a boat," she said.
He leaned forward, hands clasped between his knees.
"Yep."
Port Charlotte receded behind her.
"Am I ever going to get back off it?"
He tilted his head to the side.
"Of course. Why wouldn't you?"
"Because I can expose your double life, for starters."
He sat back, opened his palms to the idea.
"And where will that get you?"
"It won't get me anywhere. Get you in jail."
He shrugged.
"You don't think so?"
"Look, if you want, we'll turn this boat around right now and take you back. And you can drive to the nearest police station and tell them your story. And if they believe you, and let's face it, Rachel, your credibility is a little shaky in this town, then sure, they'll send some detective out tomorrow or the next day or a week from Tuesday whenever they get around to it. But by that point, I'll be smoke. They'll never find me, and you'll never find me."
The thought of never seeing him again slid through her intestinal tract like a shiv. Losing Brian, knowing he was out in the world somewhere, yet she would never see him again, would be like losing a kidney. It was a certifiably insane reaction, and yet there it was.
"Why aren't you already gone?"
"I couldn't synchronize every part of my timetable as fast as I wanted."
"What the fuck are you talking about?"
"We don't have much time,"
Brian said. "For what?"
"For anything but trust."
She stared across the boat at him.
"Trust?"
"I'm afraid so."
There were probably 1,000 things she could have said to the galactic absurdity of his asking her to trust him, but all she managed to say was, "Who is she?" She hated the words as they left her mouth. He'd stripped her of every foundation she'd built the last 3 years of her life on, and she was coming off like the jealous shrew.
"Who?"
he said.
"The pregnant wife you keep in Providence."
Another smile, bordering on a smirk, as his eyes rose to the starless sky.
"She's an associate."
"At your mineral company?"
"Well, tangentially, yes."
She could feel them dropping into the rhythm of all their fights. She typically played offense, he played an evasive defense, which usually made her more and more aggressive, like the dog chasing the rabbit that has no meat under its fur. So before it could deteriorate any further, she asked the real question.
"Who are you?"
"I'm your husband."
"You're not my..."
"I'm the man who loves you."
"You lied to me about everything in our lives. That's not love, that's..."
"Look in my eyes. Tell me whether you see love there or not."
She looked, sardonically at first, but then with growing fascination. It was there, no question. But was it? He was, after all, an actor.
"Your version of it," she said.
"Well, yeah,"
he said.
"That's the only version I'd know."
Caleb cut the engine. They were about 2 miles out in the bay, the lights of Quincy off to their right, the lights of Boston back and to their left. In front of them, the ink dark was interrupted by the ridges and crags of Thompson Island to their west. Impossible to tell in this dark if it was 200 yards away or 2,000. There was some kind of youth facility on Thompson, outward bound maybe, but whatever the organization, they'd turned in for the night, because the island emitted no light whatsoever. Small waves broke softly against the hull. She'd once piloted herself and Sebastian home on a night like this, using only their running lights, the two of them chuckling nervously through most of the journey, but Caleb had cut every light but the small bulbs of uplighting on the deck by their feet. Out there, in the impermeable dark on a moonless night, she realized Brian and Caleb could quite easily kill her. In fact,
All of this could have been orchestrated to get her to think she was supervising the events that led her to this boat and this bay and this callous dark, when in fact, it was the other way around. It suddenly seemed important to ask Brian, "What's your real name?"
"Alden," he said to her. "Brian Alden."
"Are you from a lumber family?"
He shook his head. "Nothing so glamorous."
"Are you from Canada?"
He shook his head. "I'm from Grafton, Vermont."
He watched her carefully as he removed a plastic sleeve of peanuts from his pocket, the kind they gave you on planes, and opened it. "You're Scott Pfeiffer," she said. He nodded. "But your name isn't Scott Pfeiffer."
"No. That's just the name of some kid I went to high school with. Used to make me laugh in Latin class."
"And your father?"
"Stepfather. Yeah, he was the guy I described. Racist, homophobic, scared the world was run by a large-scale conspiracy to fuck his life up and piss on everything he'd put his faith in. He was also, paradoxically maybe, a nice guy. Good neighbor, help you put up a fence or fix a gutter. He keeled over from a heart attack while shoveling a neighbor's walk. Neighbor's name was Roy Carroll. Funny thing, Roy was never even nice to him, but my stepfather shoveled his walk because it was the decent thing to do, and Roy was too poor to hire anyone to help, and he lived on a corner lot. You know what Roy did the day after my father's funeral?"
Brian popped a peanut in his mouth.
"Went out and bought himself a $3,000 snowblower."
He offered her some peanuts, and she shook her head, feeling numb to all of it suddenly, feeling as if she'd stepped into a virtual reality booth, and this was the set onto which she found herself projected. "And your real father?"
"Never really knew him."
He shrugged.
"Something we have in common."
"How about Brian Delacroix? How'd you come up with that identity?"
"You know, Rachel. You know because I told you."
And she did. "He went to Brown." Brian nodded. "And you were the pizza delivery guy?"
"Delivered in 40 minutes or less, or you get it for half price."
He smiled.
"Now you know why I drive so fast."
He shook some more peanuts into his hand. "Why," she said, "are you sitting there eating peanuts like nothing's changed?"
"Because I'm hungry."
He popped another one in his mouth.
"It was a long flight."
"There was no flight." She clenched, then unclenched her teeth. He cocked an eyebrow at her, and she wanted to tear it off his face. She wished she hadn't drunk so much. She needed to be clear-headed right now, and she wasn't even close. She had wanted to have all her questions lined up in perfect sequence. "There was no flight," she said, "because there's no job, and you're not Brian Delacroix, which means our marriage isn't even legal, and you've lied to me about..." She stopped. She could feel the dark all around her and all inside of her. "Everything." He slapped the peanut dust off his hands and pocketed the empty plastic sleeve.
"Not everything."
"Really? What's real?" He waved his fingers between their chests.
"This."
She mimicked the gesture. "This is bullshit." He actually had the temerity to look hurt. The balls.
"No, it's not, Rachel. It's as real as anything."
Caleb joined them on the deck.
"Tell me about the camera shop, Brian."
Brian said,
"What is this? Bad cop suddenly? You're both gonna grill me?" "Rachel says she followed you to Little Louie's."
A heartless cast found Brian's face. He'd worn the same look when he'd slapped Andrew Gaddis, wore it when he'd walked out of the Hancock Tower in the rain, and it had flashed across his face during a fight once, for just a second.
"How much did you tell her?" "I didn't." "You told her nothing?"
For a second, she thought Brian's voice sounded funny, like he'd bitten his tongue or cut it somehow.
"I told her we were actors. Nothing else."
His voice sounded like his own again. "I'm right here," she said. Brian looked over at her, and his eyes were dead. No, not dead. Dying. The light bled from them. She felt infinitesimal in them. He swept her body with them in a way that was clinical and lustful at the same time, the look of a man watching pornography when he wasn't even sure he was in the mood.
Caleb said,
"Why'd you go to the camera store, Brian?"
Brian held up a finger to Caleb, his eyes still moving up and down Rachel, and Caleb's face seized with the dismissiveness of the gesture.
"Don't fucking hold your finger up to me like I'm the help. Are the passports ready?"
Brian's jaw tightened even as he chuckled.
"Ho, ho, ho, my man, let's not push me tonight."
Caleb took a step toward Brian.
"You said they wouldn't be ready for another 24 hours. "I know what I said. Is this about her?"
Caleb pointed at Rachel.
"Her and her bullshit? People could fucking die because I know people could die,"
Brian said.
"My wife could die. My child could—"
"A wife and child you shouldn't have."
"But it's okay for you?"
Caleb took two more steps.
"Huh? It's okay for you?" "She's been in war zones," Brian said. "She's battle-tested. She's a shut-in."
Rachel said, "What are you two—" Caleb stepped to Brian, pointed a finger in his face.
"You lied about the fucking passports. You put us all at risk. We're gonna fucking die because you can't see past your dick."
As violence always did in her experience, the next few things happened very fast. Brian slapped Caleb's finger out of his face. Caleb whacked the side of Brian's head with a hastily clenched fist. Brian rose half out of his seat as Caleb took another swing at him, half connecting with his neck. Brian buried his fist in Caleb's solar plexus. When Caleb doubled over, Brian punched him in the ear hard enough that she could hear the cartilage crunch. Caleb stumbled sideways. He dropped to one knee and inhaled desperately for a moment. She said, "Guys, stop!" And the words sounded ridiculous. Brian rubbed his neck where Caleb had hit him and spit off the side of the boat. Caleb used the table to push himself to his feet. Then he was holding her gun in his hand. She watched him thumb off the safety, and she couldn't make sense of it at first. It characterized the surreal quality that had marked the entire day. They were Brian, Rachel, and Caleb, regular people, boring even, not the kind of people who brandished firearms. And yet it was she who'd forced Caleb to drive her here using the same gun. And now he was pointing it in Brian's face.
"Hey, tough guy, tell me where the fucking—"
When Brian struck Caleb's gun hand, the gun went off. It wasn't as loud as it sounded on the range, with partitions on either side of her. It sounded like a desk drawer being kicked shut. Judging by the muzzle flash, the bullet passed in her general direction. But she didn't scream. Brian swiped the gun out of Caleb's hand and swept Caleb's legs out from under him with the kind of ease that again suggested he'd had some wrestling experience. Caleb landed on his back, and Brian kicked him in the chest and abdomen, kicked him like he was going to kick him to death.
"Point a gun in my face?" Brian screamed. "Fucking kidding me?"
With every sentence, Brian delivered a kick.
"Try to fuck me?"
Brian kicked him in the stomach.
"Talk shit about my wife?"
A blood bubble popped from Caleb's mouth.
"Try to fuck my wife?"
Brian kicked him in the groin.
"You don't think I noticed the way you fucking drool over her, stare at her, think about her?"
When the kicks started, Caleb had begged him to stop. Now he just lay there.
"Brian, stop."
Brian turned toward her, his eyes narrowing at his gun in her hand. She couldn't remember picking it up, but she could feel its weight, so much heavier than hers, which, in Brian's hand, looked like a toy.
"Stop,"
he said. "Stop," she repeated. "You'll kill him."
"And why would you care?"
"Brian, please."
"What in your life would change if he was dead? If I was dead? Or just gone? You'll do the same thing, sit inside and look out at the world, but you won't engage it. You won't affect it. I mean, forget about him. What difference would it make if you're in the world or not?"
The words seemed to surprise him as much as her. He blinked several times. He looked at the lightless sky and the black bay, looked at Caleb, looked at her again, and she could see a realization take root. If he returned to land with an empty boat, no one would be the wiser. He raised her gun. At least she thought he raised her gun. No, he did. He raised it from his knee in a sweep, bringing it up and toward the center of himself, his right arm half-crossing his chest, and she shot him. She shot him as she'd been taught, center mass, bullet straight to the heart. She heard herself say, "Brian, no, Brian, no." She heard herself say, "No, no, no, please." Brian stumbled backward, and the blood bloomed on his shirt and then fell from his body in drops. Caleb looked at her with a mix of horror and gratitude. Brian dropped her gun. He said, "Shit." She said, "I'm sorry?" And it left her mouth like a question. And there was so much love in his eyes, and so much fear. Words left his mouth accompanied by a spoonful of blood that spilled down his chin. And she couldn't compute what he was saying to her because of the blood and his fear. He took a half-stumble step backward, his palm to his chest. He fell off the boat. And she heard clearly now what he'd said to her, what had gotten lost while the words fell from his mouth with the blood. "I love you." "Wait, wait, Brian, wait." She could see his blood on the deck and a small splatter of it on the white foam cushion of a bench by the rail. "Wait," she thought again. "We were supposed to grow old together." 3. Rachel in the World, 2014. Chapter 23. Dark. The first thing she removed was her watch, then her necklace, the same one he'd bought her in the mall 3 weeks back, kicked off her shoes, pulled off her windbreaker, followed by her t-shirt and her jeans, put everything on the table with the gun she'd used. She moved past Caleb and went down into the hold. Just to the right of the door, she found a flare gun and a first aid kit, but no flashlight. Farther down the counter, though, she found one encased in yellow plastic and black rubber. She tested it. Worked beautifully. She checked the base, solar-powered. If she'd had time to look for an oxygen tank, she could have stayed down there forever. She went back out on deck, found Caleb waiting for her by the rail.
"Listen," he said. "He's dead, and if he's not..."
She brushed past him. She stepped up on the rail. Caleb said, "Wait!" But she dove into the bay. The cold seized her heart, her throat, and her intestinal tract all at the same time. When it found her head, it drilled down through her temples, rolled through her sinuses like acid. The flashlight beam was even brighter than she could have hoped for, though, and illuminated a lime-green world of moss and seaweed, coral and sand, black boulders the size of primitive gods. She descended through the green and felt alien, very much the unnatural intruder into the natural world, the world before the world, so old it predated language, humanity, conscience. A school of cod passed within feet of her. When they were gone, she saw him. He sat on the sand about 15 feet below by a rock as old as the world. She swam down to him and treaded water in front of his corpse. She wept, her shoulders convulsing, and he stared back at her with sightless eyes. "I'm sorry." A thin rope of blood pirouetted along the rim of the hole in his chest. "I loved you. I hated you. I never knew you." His body was canted to the right, while his head was cocked to the left. "I hate you. I love you. I'll miss you for the rest of my fucking life." She stared at him, and his corpse stared back until her lungs burned and her eyes burned, and she couldn't take it any longer. "Goodbye. Goodbye." As she swam up, she saw that Caleb had turned the boat lights on. The hull bobbed on the surface, 20 feet up and about 15 yards to the south of her. She kicked for the surface and was halfway there when something grazed her thigh just above the knee. She slapped at her leg, but nothing was there, and all she managed to do was drop the flashlight. It dropped faster than she rose, and the last she saw of it, it had settled on the sandy floor, a bright yellow eye looking up toward the world. When she broke the surface, she took a great guzzle of oxygen, then swam to the boat. As she climbed aboard, she noticed a tiny island off the starboard side that she hadn't been able to make out in the dark. It was an island for birds and crabs only, barely big enough to plant one butt cheek on, definitely not two. Alone and sickly, Thin Maple pointed up from the bedrock, bent about 45 degrees by the elements. Several hundred yards away, as she'd guessed, sat Thompson, a bit more clearly defined, but just as lightless as before. On the boat, she took her clothes with her into the cabin, ignoring Caleb, who sat on the deck with his hands between his knees and his head lowered. She found a small bathroom with a sliding door just past the bed. There was a picture of them hanging over the toilet, one she'd never seen before. She remembered when it had been taken, though, because it was the first time Brian met Melissa. They'd had lunch in the North End, then walked over to Charlestown and sat on the grassy hill by the Bunker Hill Monument. Melissa had taken the picture, Rachel and Brian with their backs to each other, the monument rising behind them. They'd been smiling. No news there. People always smiled in photographs, but the smiles were genuine. They were happy, radiant. That night he'd told her he loved her for the first time. She made him wait half an hour before she said it back. She sat on the toilet seat for a few minutes and whispered his name a dozen times and wept noiselessly until her throat clogged. She wanted to explain that she was sorry because she'd killed him, and she wanted to explain that she hated him because he'd played her for a fool, but the truth was she didn't feel either of those things one-tenth as much as she felt the loss of him and the loss of who she'd been with him. So much of her essential wiring had been shorted in Haiti. Her empathy, her courage, her compassion, her will, her integrity, her sense of self-worth, and only Brian had believed it would come back. He'd convinced her the shorted wires could be refused. "Oh, Rachel," she heard her mother say, as she'd said more than once, "isn't it sad that you can only love yourself if someone else gives you permission?" She looked in the mirror and was shocked to see how much she resembled her, the famous Elizabeth Childs, the woman whose bitterness everyone always mistook for courage. "Fuck you, Mother." She stripped off her bra and underwear and dried herself with a thick towel she found on a shelf. She put her jeans, t-shirt, and windbreaker back on, found a brush, and did the best she could with her hair, staring in the mirror again at her mother around the time The Staircase had been published, yes, but also at a new version of Rachel, a killer. She had taken a life. The fact that the life had been her husband's didn't make the fact worse or better. The act itself was empirically grave no matter who was killed. She was the agent of removing human life from this planet. Had he been raising his gun? She'd thought he had. But would he have pulled the trigger? In the moment, she'd been certain he would. Now? Now she didn't know. Was the man who'd given his coat to a homeless man on a night of drenching rain capable of murder? The same man who'd psychologically nursed her through 3 years of illness with nary an impatient word or frustrated glance? Could that man commit homicide? No, that man couldn't. But that man was Brian Delacroix, a falsehood. Brian Alden, on the other hand, could slap an old friend with imperious calm. He could kick his partner and best friend with enough fury to suggest he'd never stop kicking until that friend was dead. Brian Alden had raised that gun toward her. No, he hadn't pointed it directly at her, and no, he hadn't pulled the trigger, because she hadn't given him the chance. She went back out on deck. She felt calm, too calm. And she recognized it for what it was, shock. She could feel herself in her body, but not of it. She found her gun on the deck where he'd dropped it. She tucked it in her waistband at the small of her back. She lifted Brian's gun off the table. She walked toward Caleb with it, and he narrowed his eyes at her, too late to stop her from whatever she planned to do with it. She flicked her wrist and tossed it past his head into the ocean. She looked down at him. "Help me wash the blood off the deck." Chapter 24. Kessler. On the drive back, Caleb had trouble taking clean breaths without pain. They both began to suspect Brian had fractured at least one of his ribs. Once they reached the city proper, Caleb bypassed the first exit for Back Bay. At first, she thought he meant to take the next one, but when he passed that too, she said, "What are you doing?
Driving.
Where?
I have a house that's safe. We need to go there. Figure this out.
I need to go to my apartment.
No, you don't.
Yeah, I do.
There are very pissed off people who could be after us by now. We have to get out of this city, not into it.
I need my laptop.
Fuck your laptop. With the money we'll have, you can buy a new one.
It's not the laptop, it's the book that's on it.
Download another one.
Not a book I'm reading, a book I'm writing.
He looked wildly at her as they passed under a series of bright lamps, his face white, slightly ghoulish, and helpless.
You didn't back it up?
No.
Put it in the cloud?
No.
Why the fuck not?
I need my laptop, she repeated as the exit approached. Don't make me pull the gun again.
You don't need your book with the money, you'll—
It's not about money!
Everything's about money!
Take the exit!
Fuck!
He screamed it at the ceiling and swerved the car into the exit lane. They came out of a short tunnel onto the edge of the north end and turned left and headed through Government Center toward Back Bay.
I didn't know you were writing a book,
he said at one point.
Is it like a mystery? Science fiction?
No, it's nonfiction. It's about Haiti.
That could be a tough sell.
His tone was almost chiding. She loosed a bitter chuckle.
Check your fucking privilege, my man.
He shot her an apologetic smile.
I'm just telling you the truth.
Your truth, she said.
Up in the apartment, she went into her bedroom and changed again, back into a dry bra and underwear, and swapping out the jeans for black tights, a black t-shirt, and an old gray sweatshirt from her college days at NYU. She opened her laptop and dragged the book files into a folder, something she probably should have been doing all along. She addressed an email to herself and attached the folder and hit send. Voila. Her novel was now accessible to her no matter what computer she used to access it. She came out of the bedroom with the laptop under her arm to see Caleb had made himself a drink, as she'd known he would. The kicks to the groin, he said, made sitting uncomfortable, so he stood at the kitchen bar and sipped his bourbon and gave her a 1,000-yard stare as she entered the kitchen. She said, I thought you were in a rush.
We have an hour's drive ahead.
By all means, then, she said, imbibe.
What did you do?
He said, with a hoarse whisper.
What did you do?
I shot my husband.
She opened the fridge, but then couldn't remember why, and closed it. She brought a glass to the bar and helped herself to some of the bourbon.
In self-defense?
You were there, she said.
I was on the ground. I'm not even sure I was fully conscious.
The equivocation irritated her. So you didn't see it happen?
No.
No equivocation there. So what would he say from the stand someday? Would he say she acted to save his life and her own, or would he say he wasn't fully conscious? Who are you, Caleb? She could have asked, and not in the day-to-day parts of you, but in the essential ones. She drank some bourbon. He turned his gun toward me, and I could see in his face what was going to happen, so I shot first.
You're so calm.
I don't feel calm.
You sound robotic.
It's consistent, then, with how I feel.
Your husband's dead.
I know that.
Brian.
Yes.
Dead.
Now she looked across the bar at him.
I know what I did. I just can't feel it.
Maybe you're in shock.
That'd be my guess.
A horrific realization lurked at the back of her skull, deep in the lizard folds, that for all the grief she could feel swelling in her heart, pushing and scraping at its walls, the rest of her body felt alive in a way it hadn't since Haiti. The grief would consume her when she stopped moving and stopped focusing on the problems immediately at hand, so the trick for now was to not stop moving and not widen her focus.
Will you go to the police?
They'll ask why I shot him.
Because he was kicking me to death.
They'll ask why he was doing that.
And we'll say he freaked out because you discovered his double life.
And they'll say it wasn't because you were fucking each other?
They won't go there.
It's the first place they'll go. Then they'll want to know what business you were in together, and if you had any recent disputes over money. So whatever you and Brian were into, you better hope none of it gives you motive to kill him, because then they'll decide not only were you and I fucking each other, we were fucking over Brian on a business deal, and then they'll want to know why I threw the gun in the water.
Why did you?
Because, Jesus Christ, I was fucking confused, in shock, overwhelmed, I mean, take your pick. And now, once Brian's death comes to light, I can't imagine one scenario in which I don't end up serving some time in prison, even if it's just 3 or 4 years. And I won't go to prison. Now she could feel something, a flutter of fear that bordered on hysteria. I won't sit in a box with someone else holding the key. I won't fucking do it. Caleb watched her, his mouth a small oval.
Okay. Okay.
I will not. Caleb drank a little more bourbon.
We've got to go.
Where?
A safe place. Haya's already there with the baby.
She took her laptop and keys off the counter and then stopped. His body will resurface. The realization kicked something loose in the center of her. She felt a little less numb suddenly, a little less calm. It will, won't it? He nodded. Then we have to go back.
Go back and do what?
Weigh the body down.
With what?
I don't know, bricks, a bowling ball.
Where are we going to get a bowling ball at...
He looked at the clock on the microwave.
11 o'clock at night.
He has barbells in the bedroom, 2 of them. He stared at her. For curling, you know, the little ones, they're 20 pounds each. 2 of those should do the job.
We're talking about weighing down Brian's corpse.
Yes, we are.
It's absurd.
There was nothing absurd about it. Rationally, she knew exactly what she needed to do. And maybe her shock wasn't shock at all, but was, instead, her brain divesting itself of all unnecessary data in order to process only that which was vital. She felt the same way in the squatters' camp in Laogan, moving from tent to tent, tree to tree, complete clarity of purpose. Move and hide, move and hide, move and hide. There were no larger existential questions in play, no shades of gray. Her sense of smell, sight, and hearing were not employed in pursuit of gratification, but in pursuit of survival. Her thoughts didn't wander. They marched in a straight line.
It's absurd,
Caleb said again. It's where we find ourselves right now. She headed for the bedroom to get the barbells, but stopped halfway there when the doorbell rang. It wasn't the buzzer, which is what normally rang if someone was outside the building, and it wasn't the intercom on their phone, which is how the doorman announced visitors. No, this was the small doorbell just outside her front door, 10 feet away. She looked through the eyehole and saw a black man with a trim goatee in a brown half fedora, wearing a leather car coat over a white shirt and a black skinny tie. Behind him were 2 of Boston's finest in uniform, both women. She kept the security chain on as she opened the door a crack. Yes? The man held up a gold shield and a Providence Police ID card. His name was Trayvon Kessler.
Detective Kessler, Mrs. Delacroix. Is your husband home?
No, he's not.
Do you expect him back tonight?
She shook her head. He left today on a business trip.
To where?
Russia. Kessler had a very soft voice.
Would you mind if we came in and chatted for a few minutes?
If she hesitated, this would turn adversarial, so she opened the door. Come in. He removed his hat as he crossed the threshold and placed it on the seat of the antique chair to his left. His skull was shaven, as she'd somehow known it would be, and gleamed in the dim light of the entryway like polished marble.
"This is Officer Mullen,"
he said, indicating the blonde cop with bright, friendly eyes and freckles that matched her hair.
"And that's Officer Garza."
He indicated the dark-haired, heavy-set woman with a hungry gaze that was already drinking in the apartment. The gaze fell quickly on Caleb, standing at the kitchen bar with a bottle of bourbon. Rachel noticed she'd left the bottle of wine she'd polished off earlier on the corner of the bar as well, between an empty wine glass and the rocks glass she'd just half-filled with bourbon. It looked like they were throwing a party in here. Caleb came over and shook their hands, introduced himself as Brian's partner. Then, in the silence that followed, with the 3 cops looking at the apartment with cops' eyes, Caleb got nervous.
First name's Trayvon,
he said to Kessler, and Rachel wanted to shut her eyes in horror. Kessler took in the bottle of bourbon and the empty wine bottle.
Everyone calls me Trey, though. But like that kid in Florida, right?
Caleb said.
The one who got